Take a network break. The Supreme Court says states can now collect sales tax from online retailers, so don't be surprised if the price of your virtual donuts go up. I'm Drew Connery Murray. Greg Farrow is here. Today's episode is sponsored in part by us, the Packet Pushers. We launched a brand new membership site. It's at ignition.packetpushers.net. There's a free option. There's also a paid option, $99 a year, that gives you access to exclusive content like white papers, courses, and videos. You can find out more at ignition.packetpushers.net.
Hugely excited. Hugely excited.
We are excited. Yeah, this is a new thing for us.
Yeah, this is our chance. If you've ever wanted to support us in the past, lots of people have offered to support us. We're still building out the content. We're working very hard to publish new and interesting content in there. But maybe you want to look at that $99 for the year as to support Packet Pushers and help us to transition, stabilize our business model for the years ahead. And that's basically where we're heading here is, you know, we'll never get rich from this, but if we're in business, we're still having fun. And maybe you want to sign up at Ignition and give us some money to keep the mission, to keep the project going.
And you'll get something in return too. This isn't just a handout. Yeah. We're developing content. There's content in there now. So you should get something for your money. But you know, if you've always thought about contributing, this is an opportunity and you get something for it too.
Well, if you like Network Break and listening to my unique perspective on the industry, you're going to like some of the videos and the white papers I'm going to publish and eBooks.
That's right. Yeah, there's already stuff there. So go check it out, ignition.packetpushers.net. Also, stay tuned after the news. We've got a sponsored Coffee Talk conversation with Mellanox, and we're going to be talking about data center fabrics, in particular, building fabrics using VXLAN and EVPN. So stay tuned after the news for that. All right, to the news. Aruba Networks, they've announced a new platform called SD Branch. It offers SD-WAN capabilities, the usual stuff, but you also can manage branch switches and APs, assuming you've got the Aruba gear, and also assuming that you've bought into ClearPass, which is Aruba's access management software, similar to Cisco's ICE.
Kind of a lot of conditions to get involved in this, isn't it?
Well, if you just want the SD-WAN, you can get it sort of standalone, but if you want to do all the cool extra stuff they say you can do, you're going to have to invest in Aruba, yeah.
Yeah, The thing about this is, of course, is that it's cloud-based. So it actually has a whole cloud platform behind it. And really, there's only three things that it does. One is dynamic path selection, which is pretty much the core of any SD-WAN solution.
Right.
Has the cloud management, so it has some analytics. From what I could see, the analytics isn't as rich as competitors. So we could say that Aruba is still working on this product. So we're probably looking at a very early release to say, don't leave, we've got something. And they also have some security partnerships with Checkpoint, Palo Alto, and Zscaler, as you might expect, which is quite good. So I would regard this as a beta release, maybe earlier, maybe an alpha release. There seems to be like they've got some basic features, but there's nothing in here that separates it away from other competitors' products except for ClearPass, the integration with ClearPass.
Right. And if you do that integration with ClearPass, then you can get more insights. You can set up sort of role-based or user-based policies that push all the way out to the branch, which could be nice. My take is that Aruba has a lot of retail outfits as customers, a lot of branches, and they see this as an opportunity to sort of keep those customers with Aruba as opposed to going elsewhere. Like I know Meraki is also flirting with SD-WAN, and of course there's a million other SD-WAN providers. So this to me seems like a let's protect our market share, and then over time maybe they'll try to expand out and grow into non-Aruba customers. But to me this seems like initially this is for Aruba folks day one.
Yeah, so we're definitely seeing a merging of the idea of the branch LAN and the branch WAN.
Mm-hmm.
They're merging together into one thing, and it's going to be called a software-defined branch.
Yep.
Cisco's certainly doing that, although they're doing it slower than others. Viptela is now called IWAN 3, and it has the cloud gateway and the cloud analytics, but it's certainly upscale. Aruba obviously is going to leverage its strengths. Its core strength is around ClearPass with users and role-based access control, and that's how they're going to define their micro-segmentation. But if you look at how it's going to compete, you know, with branches now connecting directly to cloud services, to Azure and to Office 365 and, you know, localized internet breakout. I think that VeloCloud's got a bit of a storm on here that, you know, with NSX, because they're going to be able to integrate it with NSX in the data center. And then in the cloud as well, if you're going to be using NSX to orchestrate your network in the cloud, whether you will or you won't, it remains to be seen. But, you know, VeloCloud's much stronger in that sense. So I think that Aruba is, in a sense, being forced to play here. And they don't seem to have sort of raced out to this. They've sort of realized that they have to put something down here. And I think there's some innovation yet to come. They're going to have to work fairly hard to convince people to switch over to this. But if you are a ClearPass customer, I'll bet good money that your Aruba rep will be on your doorstep any day now to start selling your SD-WAN.
That's an easy bet. I'll take that one too.
Especially if you've got a lot of branches. But yes, this is very much about, I would say, about the branch. You know, if you've got a lot of branches, say 1,000 or more, and some of them are quite small, you want something simple, low features, low complexity, this is the sort of technology that you can get into, and this is exactly where Aruba would be able to shine. The only thing that's in the back of my mind here is, why did it take them so long? This has been obviously on the table for some time, and the question would be, why aren't they buying somebody else and then just strapping their cloud platform in? Why would they develop themselves? And I can't help but wonder if, you know, Aruba and HPE and the whole environment there with HPE going in different directions made it a little bit difficult for them to move forward. Aruba likes to do things itself. It likes to do them in-house. HPE's changing the way it runs its business and, you know, how much money has it got to spend, and is very careful about cash. It's making acquisitions, but, you know, smart acquisitions. And consistently, HPE has shown that they don't want to do networking. They're quite happy to leave it to Arista or anybody else but them, sort of thing.
Yeah, I've got to wonder about that, because they've got this networking company, Aruba Networks, and Aruba's been trying to do new things like building a campus switch. And it does feel like HPE is not giving them a lot of love.
We also get the same thing from Dell. We had a briefing this week from the OpenSwitch team at Dell. And not that OpenSwitch is an open source project, but it's largely staffed by Dell people. And the thing is that no matter how hard I try, I just can't see Dell as a serious networking company, because I've never seen a senior executive at Dell say networking is core to our business,
right,
like we've seen with other companies. So if you can't be in this business unless you're in networking. So that's the challenge I have. And Aruba doesn't kind of want to be part of HPE. They kind of want to be out of it, even though they got bought by HPE. Anyway, so this is good. I think this is great. Aruba rounds out its portfolio, gets to do something in the branch, and let's see how they develop in the months ahead.
That's right. All right, moving on. Cisco, they've acquired July Systems. This is a small company that specializes in wireless location services, that is using Wi-Fi and mobile devices for things like wayfinding when you're in a big venue, or upselling you when you're at a retail location, and of course, gathering data about visitor behavior for your analytics.
Creepy stalker boyfriend right here.
That's right. Product. Right on your phone.
Yeah. So if this July Systems is a product where if you go into some sort of retail location or some sort of building and you connect to their Wi-Fi, they'll start to track you as you move around the building, literally. So the classic case that they talk about on their website is if you walk in to a shopping mall and you connect to their free Wi-Fi, then they'll track you around the store, where you are, what you are. And the idea would be that it would then integrate with display advertising. Cisco has a big display advertising business. And so when you walk past it, it might start to show you. And if your big thing is looking at, you know, $2,000 TVs because there's some pigskin game with grown men and pigskin on, then you might want to see an ad for Magic Televisions, because that's important to you. So I think the thing to note about this too is that Cisco, that July Systems was an OEM partner in Cisco's mobile connected experience. So what we're seeing is this. Remember, I've made jokes several times about companies need to put a ring on it instead of making partnerships?
Right.
Well, Cisco's obviously been dating here before slapping a ring on it.
They decided to live together for a couple of years before they got married.
So it's sort of like sniffing around. So that's interesting. July Systems, of course, is cloud-based. Everything's going to be cloud-based, I think, from Cisco for the foreseeable future. They're not going to drop cash on something that's an on-prem. It's an off-prem. But Cisco gets to add user profiling to people in public spaces, which, quite honestly, creepy boyfriend material, that's it right there.
That's the world we live in.
Welcome to the 2018s.
AT&T, they are selling 31 data centers in the U.S. and overseas. They're going to collect about $1.1 billion for it. The buyer is a company called Brookfield Infrastructure Partners.
Yeah, this is the thing here is that AT&T is buying Time Warner for $85 billion or some stupidly large number.
Obscene number, yes.
Yeah, so you would imagine that AT&T has been looking at its portfolio and preparing its cash. We know that I've talked many times on the show about the fact that telcos in years gone by thought that building data centers on the back of their backbones was going to be big money. And then, of course, content delivery networks came along and put all the traffic at the edge. We didn't need the backbones. And then the cloud companies came along and ran the data centers better than these companies ever could.
That's right.
So now you have venture capitalists so companies like Brookfield Infrastructure Partners, they buy these properties as a real estate trust. So they look at it as though it's a building that you can then rent. So they buy the data center, they lease out the building to somebody else to operate the building. There are literally companies who will run data centers for you, and they treat it like it's a 25-year to 50-year real estate investment. They get the land. That's completely different to the way AT&T needs to get cash flow and, you know, leverage business to make profits out of it. So it's money's been put into a different bucket there. So I imagine that this is going, the signs that we've seen Verizon sell off its cloud companies and its data centers steadily over the last 2 years. This is AT&T cleaning that up and demonstrating clearly that public cloud companies, the terrible 10 as they're now called, have been beating the big beasts of telecom comprehensively And so now they're getting out of it so they can focus on not running data centers.
That's right. And speaking of things that the telcos are trying to do to stay fresh and alive, according to Axios, AT&T may purchase a digital ad exchange company called AppNexus. And according to those reports, that's going to likely cost AT&T around $2 billion. So I guess they're getting $1 billion for the data centers, and they're going to spend $2 billion to buy an ad exchange network.
This is the trend that I've been telling you about, is that the U.S. telcos in particular see their telecom networks as data sources. They've already been making a $25 to $50 billion market out of selling your information to ad tech companies. We saw this week, of course, there was a big foo-foo-rah in the U.S. when people realized that they were selling data to scummy ad tech companies and some scummy ads were following them around. Well, those telcos can now stop that because they now, with the combination of the network, buying with net neutrality, giving them the ability to run their own ad tech companies and to run their own content companies, they're now going to be able to say, here's your content. We can put ads on that site and target you, like hyper-target you, because we know where you live. We know what your salary is. We know you're a customer with us. We know what you're doing on the network.
Right. We know where you like to go on the internet.
And then if you hit any of our sites where we own the content, we can actually then do much better and much more higher price targeting of that ad and get much more results out of you. And that's why AT&T, you'll see Verizon's out there shopping around for them. I remember rightly, AT&T's done about three of these deals this week where it's been noted to be out buying ad tech companies. I expect you'll see a slew of them because they need to get big very quickly.
Right.
So at a $2 billion ad tech company, this one's actually not that large. It's actually moderate. It's quite mid to small to mid-sized. Good starting point. They can probably grow it, but they need a Google, you know, they're going to need a much larger sized ad tech network to pay off the sort of money and get a return out of buying Time Warner.
Right. Again, back to the content. It's not just pipes. It's about content and it's about ads. Yeah.
Yeah. Remember Verizon bought Yahoo? That's content. So now you've got the network acting as ad tech, and now you buy an ad tech company. So now you're vertically integrated. You start to look like General Electric. Of course, that didn't work out for General Electric.
Right, which is divesting. Right.
General Electric got delisted from the Fortune 500 this week because the company's value is collapsing so fast. First time in 100 and something years that it's not been sitting in the Fortune 500.
I think it was one of the last 20th century corporations to be taken off, if not the last. Yeah.
Yeah. So conglomerates like this, you know, telcos, ad tech, content, hard to see how that's going to be successful. But we'll see.
I know they call, I think the business term is vertical integration. So you've got the network, you've got the content, and you've got the advertising exchange in place. So you've you've got it all tidy in one bucket.
Good luck trying to make that work.
All right, sticking with telcos, Deutsche Telekom, they are going to lay off 10,000 employees in their T-Systems business. T-Systems offers IT services and outsourcing, and it's been struggling with profitability. According to Reuters, T-Systems caused Deutsche Telekom to write off more than €1 billion in 2017. And I guess they brought in an American to cut costs and drive profitability.
Yeah, that's pretty much what it is. So Deutsche Telekom, we talked last week about DT had missed was it last week or the week before?
I think it was the week before, yeah.
They targeted $2 billion, like $1 billion in savings over the last X years and completely failed to hit that target. Like none of it happened. So they've got a real problem. They've sort of been saying they've got to get cheaper, and they obviously can't do content because of the laws over here in Europe. So in years gone past, T-Systems was an outsourcing business. The idea was that they would offer managed IT service and outsourcing, and that business is obviously in deep trouble. You know, between the cloud, hyper-convergent, software-defined, which makes it easier for customers to run it themselves, and the sheer embuggerance of outsourcing. Like outsourcing is just a dead set failure. It's always been miserably done. You know, nobody wins when you outsource your IT. It has to be run by yourself to a larger or lesser degree. And we've seen the Indian outsourcers all stumbling over the last 5 years. I was reading a list of articles I wrote a piece in an ebook I'm just completing now about the failure of outsourcing. And pretty much since 2012, writers in India have been talking about the end of outsourcing and how that market is dying off very quickly. And so now it's coming home to T-Systems. The challenge here is that in Germany, unions and government legislation make it extremely difficult to cut staff. And most German workers do not change jobs. They expect to join a company at, you know, leaving school, and they will be there when they retire. The company will never get rid of them. The company will retain, they're looked after by the company. So for them to be able to promise this sort of cuts, like 2,000 jobs a year, And they're not just going to get rid of the workers, they're going to get rid of the managers as well. And those people really know how to fight. This is going to be a really brutal fight. T-Systems is dead, though. Like, it's either that or just shut it down, right? But the big problem that Germany has is, that German companies have, is that they cannot get rid of staff until they get into desperate situations. And so they actually get much further into the pain before they do this, because they just can't shrink as they need to. They can only hold on to staff and until the good times come back.
Yeah, you mentioned those German offices are planning to go from 200 down to 20. So really, really deep cuts.
Yes, and to go from 8 layers of management to 3.
Yeah, that's right. They said a lot of the cuts are going to come in middle management.
Yeah, he told staff a saving of 600 million euros. We'll invest the cash to make the company profitable again. The company wants to cut 2,000 jobs a year in Germany. First in overhead and management positions, the second in offshoring. So they're going to move jobs offshore. That's going to get the government right up in arms. And then finally in delivery positions. So in other words, ramp up automation to replace out people in the working layers. You know, and the number of management layers will be cut from 8 to between 3 and 5. So that's going to be a brutal thing. And they're going to get, the government's going to be all over them. So I doubt they'll get there.
Tough times at T-Systems.
Mm-hmm.
All right, sticking with telcos, the Australian telco giant Telstra, they've announced plans to split off their legacy wired infrastructure division into a separate company that's going to be called Telstra InfraCo. The new company is going to include fixed line infrastructure, data centers, copper, undersea cable, and other assets like poles and ducts.
So yet another telco story. So one of the stories that we've seen in Europe and throughout Asia is that a lot of companies, telcos, don't want to own their infrastructure. They don't want to own the poles and the ducts, because if they do, they have to support it and pay for it themselves. And increasingly, they're actually sharing that. So what Telstra is doing here, the logic would say, there's already a company in Australia that actually owns telephone poles and ducts and fiber and all that sort of stuff and runs it, and then is owned then respectively by the telcos who use it. So each of the telcos effectively doesn't own that infrastructure, but they own the company that does own it, if you know what I mean.
Okay.
And so some of it's listed on the stock exchange as an infrastructure investment, and the rest of it is actually owned by the telcos themselves, who then have a controlling vote in what's done and what the spending is. Telstra said, no, we own our infrastructure, we operate it, we believe that the future is, you know, doing it all ourselves. And now they're realizing not so much. So the goal here, of course, would be to take all of their infrastructure, put it in a separate company, and then start sharing it with other people so they can share the cost of running that.
Yeah, just to be clear, all of the infrastructure that they're separating out is on old wired line technology. Anything related to mobile assets, mobility, that's going to stay with the original Telstra.
Yeah, they'll run their own telco network, but what the telco network connects to.
Right.
The mobile network connects to will be shared. And that way they can start sharing the costs of all of that stuff. And now maybe they can actually float it off. Most likely they'll end up selling it off into listing some of it on the stock exchange and finding some shared investors and getting some other telcos into the Australian market might be a pathway out. They're also talking about 9,500 job cuts, $2 billion in asset sales, an increase in its cost savings target from $1.5 billion to $2.5 billion. So if you were thinking that there's going to be a revival in the service provider market and that routers and switches being sold into the service provider's market are going to rise, you're in for a nasty surprise. Telstra is one of Cisco's biggest customers. And if you're talking about that sort of cuts, you're talking about less sales in that particular market. And, you know, telcos that continue to believe they can build services on top of their network, that's what they think they can do. And that service might be content like what Netflix is doing. But I don't think they don't want to be a utility bandwidth business. So they're going to farm that off into a real estate investment fund where, you know, you make 5 to 7%. The expectation isn't that you'll make 25%. It's not cool being utility. And right. A lot of these people have pretty substantial ego. I suspect that they can't do it. They'll fail miserably and just stumble off into being a utility.
We'll see. They're desperately trying to avoid that fate, particularly here in the US.
As always.
All right, a quick break. We mentioned this at the top of the show. Just another reminder to tell you about ignition.packetpushers.net. This is the new membership site that we've launched with a free tier and a paid tier, $99 a year. And again, if you sign up for the free tier, that gets you the link propagation newsletter, human infrastructure newsletter, and some sponsored virtual design clinic videos. On the paid side, you get all of that stuff on the free side, but also there's unsponsored virtual design clinic videos. There's courses. We're going to be hosting exclusive podcasts. Greg's creating new content all the time. So head on over to ignition.packetpushers.net. Check it out.
That's right. If you've got any ideas about what we could do for you, don't hesitate to let us know. We do like to reflect what you want. And if there's something that you want to do, I'm working on a video right now, which is how to compare three-tier tree networks to ECMP and a bunch of other topics. And I'm also looking at doing a series of what I'm calling my hot button which is a nice way of saying my ranty topic. So you know the sorts of topics. If you're a regular listener of the show, you know I like to get a bit frothy and a bit mouthy about certain topics like MPLS and QoS. I'm actually going to show you my working. I'm going to explain why I think they are in detail, and that'll all be part of the free of the content in the Ignition membership if you pay up. And as I said, if you've always wanted to support us, if you think that what we're giving you is valuable, this is your chance to sign up, join the membership, and then we'll give you something back.
That's right. Yeah, it's not just a giveaway.
No.
All right. Yeah, so ignition.packetpushers.net, go check it out. Moving on, there's a company called Signal Sciences. They sell a web application firewall product. They have an interesting and somewhat self-serving blog about why web app firewalls get purchased but rarely ever installed. I read this, and essentially the take is that web app firewalls haven't evolved to keep up with modern application architectures, but organizations buy them to sort of tick that compliance checkbox but don't actually run them in line or put them in blocking mode.
Well, that was what I did when I was doing it. we buy our WAF, we put it in line, and as somebody replied to me in a tweet, you point at it and the auditor goes away. It's auditor repellent.
It's like garlic and vampires.
I think the marvelous quote was in the article where the guy was talking to somebody who'd retired from a WAF vendor, and he was the chief salesperson, or like a sales, one of the sales managers. He said, well, this may seem basic, but I think this is the most important lesson I've learned in my position. Don't ignore customers after you close the deal to just focus on the next new deal.
That's pretty jaw-dropping.
Yeah, that's right. And I think we've seen a lot of that in enterprise IT, but in networking in particular, you know, and the Cisco model, which I've been fairly vocal about, the Cisco sales model of close the deal at any price, kill, slay, lie, steal, you know, whatever, to get the deal, you know, and then you just get out of there and get on to the next deal, focus on the next customer, and then just leave the pile of rubbish behind and let the customer work out and the reseller to work out what's going to happen with all of that. And the challenge here, of course, is that that builds up over time. So WAFs might have been sold very well, and companies have sold a lot of web application firewalls, but they're not turned on. And so they're not really interested in buying a new one or signing up for an upgrade or as a security appliance because they've never used it. They don't know anything about it. And it's just there until the auditor stops asking for it. That's a dead end business model.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's been a, I don't know, dead end, but it's certainly not a business model that's going to win you a lot of support from customers.
No, customers don't love you because you're not giving them anything. You've got the money,
right,
but the customer's not any loyalty. And I just, there's an interesting thing here, of course, is that maybe subscription revenues has an angle here. If you're paying a subscription revenue, if you buy a WAF, put it down in front, but never activate it, you could probably turn the license off after a few months and just put the money back in your pocket, knowing you could always turn it back on if you needed to.
I guess.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting. You know, if you don't use the product, you don't pay for it, I guess. And then all of a sudden you've got a problem where you think, hang on, because for vendors, if you sell something, if you're on a subscription license and customers don't pay for that license for 2 or 3 years at least, you're not getting an ROI on the hardware, right? You need to have that whole value there. It could be interesting. So maybe there is some case for subscription revenues actually aligning with what customers want. They want the product to work. They want the product to actually be useful. And if you can't, well, then maybe you shouldn't be doing it. Yeah,
that's right. And just make sure if that's what you're doing, turn it on before the auditor comes in.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you don't. You have it turned on. You just haven't got it.
The blinky light is there. So check
well,
that
it
box.
Always allows. It allows the application people to point at the WAF, and the networking people say, well, we've got a WAF, but you've got to tell us what you want to configure. And they say, well, we'll tell you what we've got to configure once we do a security review. And it goes off to the security team, and they say, well, we'll schedule that in the 6-monthly test. And then by the time the test gets done, it comes back from the security team, everybody's sort of like run off and done something else, and nobody really cares.
So that's right.
That's how it works, I'm afraid.
All right, moving on. HPE Discover was last week, and CEO Antonio Neri declared that the company is going to invest $4 billion in edge computing.
Yeah, this is entirely predictable, I think. Edge computing is obviously a good opportunity for the legacy IT vendors, Dell, Cisco, HPE, etc. And they're all going to be making moves into producing products that fit the edge computing market. The most common for this is, you know, you're going to see factories have hundreds of sensors, and you're going to need to have like a mini data center that pulls all that data together before it uploads it to the cloud for, you know, different analysis. And if you're obviously collecting data by the bucket load, you actually only want to send a cup load over the backbone because it's actually quite latency. It's going to be quite slow. So you need to do some processing locally, close the feedback loop, and then you need to upload it to the bigger set of data for that.
So that means you're going to need some hardware locally and also some very smart, expensive software to do all that data analysis for you.
Indeed. So it's an obvious move to build a sort of a converged systems for a high-intensity on-premise use case, right?
Right.
Like data centers is data centers, but now you're going to need something that runs at room temperature on a factory floor, or, you know, it's going to be a bit more environmentally aware. And this is the sort of business that HP and Dell have been in for years, right? So the interesting part was, you think $4 billion is actually real money, or do you, right? The CEO, Antonio Neri, says it's a strategic organic investment. In other words, it's $4 billion worth of money we've already got, but we're going to use it to do edge. So it's not new money. It's not new products. It's products that we've already got. We're just going to bundle them up and use them for edge. So it's sort of this, HP has this history of coming up with big headlines like this and, you know, eye-dropping and a great headline. But when you come to sort of poke at it, there's not a lot of substance in there. And I sort of felt that this might be one of those.
I think all the legacy vendors that we cover are talking about multi-cloud, and a lot of them are also talking about edge, that they see new opportunity here, again, because you can sell hardware and software. I think, you know, they can make a case for it. But yeah, there's a lot of, you know, flapping of big numbers around as if they're going to be doing something new here, as opposed to just taking what they've already got and putting a new badge on it.
There's not new money here. They've already got $4 billion worth of servers that, you know, they're going to rebundle, reconverge. You're going to take some sort of hyperconverged platform with some storage arrays and maybe make a version of that which operates at room temperature or something like that. But that's, you know, the number is strategic organic investment. In other words, it's just depends on how you want to slice it up on the sales spreadsheet.
Yeah, I don't really know what organic means in this. what is inorganic investment? Okay, I guess strategic
it's
organic.
Not net new investment is what I'm hearing.
Okay. Got it. All right. Our last story for today, Intel CEO Brian Krasnick resigned last week after it was disclosed he had a consensual affair with an employee. Intel put out a very terse statement saying that Krasnick violated Intel's non-fraternization policy, and so he is out.
Yeah, a bit weird. This seems to have happened very quickly. I'm not normally very big on these Me Too things, but it's very hard not to look at this and go like, you know, AMD Epic has been getting good traction with Dell, HP, Cisco, and a range of cloud companies lining up to take on that CPU. Intel's transition to 7-nanometer CPU designs has been, you know, pretty miserable. They're now predicting 2020, 2019. They've had no desktop CPUs. Profits are all up, so they've done a great job in selling it, but really the long-term pipeline's looking a bit, you know, the 3D Crosspoint stuff hasn't come out. The NVMe transition's taken much longer than they originally expected. You can't help but wonder if maybe the board sort of went, okay, we've got a problem here. Let's get him out the door and get a new CEO in and see if we can't turn this around, because we're starting to lose momentum in the market.
This totally, to me, read like a pretext. Like, we want to get rid of him. We sort of need a reason. Oh, here's one. Okay, bye. Bye, Brian.
Yeah. Mm. And it might be that affair, and it was consensual, apparently, so it's not like it's harassment or anything like that, but there is a non-fraternization policy. That does feel like a leverage. Somebody had some political leverage, and when the right time came around, they activated it and got him out. So I'm sure he'll pop up somewhere else. These CEOs of these big companies, their egos are certainly, you know, large enough and robust enough to pop up somewhere else in the near future. He'll have a few months of gardening leave, I'm sure, or boating leave, or running leave. I think he's a big runner.
Okay, you can get some miles in.
But this does seem a bit odd. Semi-Accurate, there's a website called semiaccurate.com, who is a very close follower of the Intel, and he basically says the same thing. You know, Intel's 10-nanometer process flat out doesn't work. The company is losing huge chunks of its core server market to AMD and has no way back. Their current efforts hold the line, prop up margins, and it has seriously alienated customers. So, like I said, financially, the customer is in great shape. Profits and sales are high. But it's alienating customers because they're just charging more for the same products. And there's no end, like there's nothing here. So as he is very critical, some like far more cynical than I think is reasonable, but he's right. Roadmaps are messy and they change faster than the ink can run dry. 3D Crosspoint should have been here, you know, long ago.
Yeah. My perception of this is that Intel is trying to make it like they're doing something moral and upstanding. And I feel like if they were actually happy with the CEO, then they would have given him a slap on the wrist instead of sending him away.
This feels like boardroom politics.
Yeah, it doesn't feel to me like the moral play, because if they're really that interested in morality, maybe they would have thought about having him resign after that suspicious stock sale.
Yes.
Before the release of the Spectre meltdown vulnerabilities, for instance.
Of course,
if you want to take the moral high ground, let's look at
unless
that.
Unless he sold the stock back then when that started to get well known, and it's taken up till now for a boardroom push to get him out, to kick him out.
Right.
That would be my bet. This looks political. This looks like the boardroom's decided you know, some, not the whole boardroom, but some faction of the boardroom found this out and used this to leverage him out, and they're going to get a new CEO. Anyway, the company's followed its CEO succession plan and appointed the so who cares who? It's just another body.
they've got a body in place.
I'm not a big fan of this name CEOs. I don't think CEOs are as all that as people get out. I mean, they wouldn't be in the job if they didn't have the skills. And you'd have to be crazy to be those people, quite honestly. But, you know, they had a nominated successor if something happened, and the nominated successor steps up, and I'm sure he'll do almost identical as what the previous person did.
Yeah, and I also want to say I'm not dismissing the severity and seriousness of inappropriate workplace relationships, particularly when there's a power differential between a CEO and an employee. That kind of thing should be taken very seriously in an organization. My feeling is that Intel, if they were happy with the CEO, they would have found a way to keep him on the job.
I think so.
All right. Well, that's just my speculation, but that takes us to the end of this episode, the news portion of this episode. Please do stay tuned for a sponsored Coffee Talk conversation. Greg spoke with Mellanox. They're going to be digging into data center fabrics on VXLAN and EVPN. You talked that it was a good conversation.
Quite interesting. Yeah. Mellanox's product is quite unique in the sense that they make their own ASICs and they use a combination of software. You can either use their own software or you can use Cumulus to get the features that they want. But in particular, their EVPN, so their BGP EVPN solution, which is all the rage this year, is actually quite a long way ahead. And it's probably worth listening into this story as we talk about just what that can be doing.
All right, we'll take a listen because that's coming right up.
Welcome to Coffee Talk from the Packet Pushers, a short sponsored conversation to help you get up to speed on new technologies and ideas in about the time it takes to drink a coffee. I'm Greg Farrow, and our sponsor today is Mellanox Technologies, and we're going to be talking about data center fabrics. More specifically, we're going to be talking about a combination of EVPN and VXLAN as a replacement for your Layer 2 network. It's very modern, it's very fancy, but it's the way of the future. Layer 3 at the bottom for stability and safety, and Layer 2 over the top. Our guests today are from Mellanox, are David Iles, Senior Director of Ethernet Switches, and Karthik Mandakolator, who's also a senior director in product marketing. Let's get straight to the first question. Not everybody is familiar with who Mellanox. So, Davis, can you give us a quick intro to Mellanox Technologies?
Sure. Yeah. So, Mellanox Technologies started about 19 years ago, and we make data center products. So we make the switches, we make the NICs, we make the cables and optics. We also do InfiniBand for the largest supercomputers in the world. But the topic of today is the Ethernet portfolio.
I've always liked the end-to-end strategy there. Not only do you do the switches, but you also do the NICs and the cables between them. So it's truly one of the only companies who'll actually certify all of the kit that you need to build a data center LAN.
That's a great point. There are very few companies that can do all of that. And actually, we like to think that if you have the NICs and the switches and the cables from one company, there are things that we can do that other people can't do.
Indeed. Now, the topic for today is the modern data center fabric. One of the things that we've seen a lot of people do is trill an SPB to get that luscious layer 2 all the way across the network. But it's not all roses and happiness, is it?
No. Actually, people have found that Trill and SPB, while they're standards, very few interoperability exists. You get it from one vendor, it doesn't work the same way as another vendor, and at the end of the day, they're actually both suffer from the same problem, that they're just one big layer 2 fabric.
Well, the idea behind Trill and SPB, of course, was that you're tunneling layer 2. You're tunneling Ethernet over Ethernet, and then you're applying some sort of layer 3-like routing protocols to reduce the difficulty of layer 2. But the problem I always saw was that these implementations were kind of incomplete. They didn't have this metadata capability that you needed.
Yeah, I mean, among other things, I think people rapidly started adopting VXLAN as a solution to this, maybe a better solution. But because there wasn't a great standard for how you orchestrate that, people would say, hey, listen, I'm going to use a controller. You know, I'll kind of throw out, you know, protocols and just do it all from some centralized point. So EVPN today kind of solves that and says, well, let's go back to using protocols to build large scalable data centers and carve them up with VXLAN instead of using like a proprietary controller.
So VXLAN does layer 2 over layer 3. So effectively you're tunneling Ethernet over IP routing. That's much more stable, but it's also much more SDNable, if you like, or it's much more able to be configured at scale.
It does. It actually kind of makes both sides of the camp happy. You got application guys that really want things at layer 2. So you got to have layer 2.
Yeah.
But then a lot of the network guys are saying, well, I want to have everything layer 3 as much as possible, push it down so that I have you know, the very small fault domains and something that's, you know, infinitely scalable. So it kind of makes both sides of the camp happy.
So EVPN is where you're using VXLAN with a BGP as a control plane.
That's correct. You know, EVPN started as kind of a better VPLS. It was for connecting layer two across different disparate regions. But nowadays, you know, EVPN's used for the data center for kind of orchestrating how VXLANs get carved up. And so they let the network kind of scale, right? The top of rack switches get to talk to other top of rack switches using BGP. And in fact, we've even seen some servers talking BGP with EVPN as well. So that's kind of a little more future stuff.
Yeah, I think that long-term we're going to see the virtual switches in the servers start to participate in EVPN as that takes time to roll out. Everybody knows that the network extends into the virtual switch these days. And as the rest of the market converges on EVPN, I think it's fair to say that that's probably where it's going to be, EVPN everywhere.
I think so. I think we're going to see a lot more. We already see that quite a bit. We're seeing in OpenStack, you know, you've got this thing called Bagpipe where they're trying to adopt EVPN. We're seeing early adopters across the, you know, lots of people doing BGP just in general all the way down to their server. It just EVPN is just a natural standardized way of doing it.
So what you're trying to get away from here now, I think the point that you were making to us, you know, as we did the preparation for this, was that not everybody needs to be using an SDN controller to make this work.
Right. Actually, it probably SDN was a good kind of first step, you know, the using a controller based solution. The problem with the controller usually is then you're locked into one particular vendor and there's not a lot of choice. With a protocol like BGP, everybody supports BGP and it is a standard approach. And in when you have standards, it usually drives down the cost. It makes things kind of interoperate better. And at the end of the day, it comes up with a better solution for, you know, kind of the consumer of the technology.
I think there's a certain group of people for whom SDN controllers don't make sense. Maybe you've got a software overlay that's driven by some sort of software and you just want to, you know, or you'd be more familiar with something that's run on BGP. You know, it's this range of choices which makes life, the modern data center LAN, interesting, much more interesting than ever was before, instead of just being stuck with a fat tree MLAG set up, you know, with three tiers.
Yeah, where it becomes seems very interesting is this mix of bare metal servers and software, you know, hypervisors. When you the bare metal server really isn't well served with controllers. Controllers like to reach into your server and control things and kind of poke and prod and tell it exactly what to do. People offering bare metal servers, there's no hypervisor there for them to poke and prod. Or if there is, it's not. It doesn't belong to the guy that has the controller.
Now, with the Mellanox solution, you're actually reasonably open because you're partnering with Cumulus Networks to provide this EVPN implementation.
Exactly. Exactly. Actually, we would argue that Cumulus makes the world's best kind of software for EVPN. They are pushing the standard. They're pushing EVPN into free-range routing, into Linux. Like, Linux kernel has been updated a lot by Cumulus. And then that pairs well with the Mellanox hardware because we feel we make the best EVPN hardware in terms of kind of VXLAN scale, the VXLAN functionality. If you want 100 gigabit and VXLAN and routing, there's a lot of like caveats with a lot of the merchant silicon. And the Mellanox silicon has none of those caveats. And that's why it pairs well with, I think, the Cumulus best of breed software with Mellanox best of breed hardware.
And that also gives you the opportunity to run that operating system across a range of switches if that's the choice that you go down. But I think the Mellanox hardware's got some serious advantages, right?
First, we are able to do VXLAN packets in a single pass for VXLAN routing. Not just that, we support both modes of VXLAN routing, be it symmetric or asymmetric. And in terms of scale, Spectrum Ethernet switches have the best scale in the industry. We are able to support many more VTEPs for head-on replication, as well as a number of tunnels. We can support 100K tunnels. That's substantially higher than what anybody else can support out there.
So let's get back to the beginning. There's a couple of things you pointed out there that aren't necessarily open to it. If you're terminating EVPN, one of the challenges is that you quite often have to route as you bring the frame out of the VXLAN, you need to actually then route it and bridge it at the same time. Some switches need to pass that through an ASIC multiple times. Some ASICs, you need to actually pass it through multiple switches. You can't do it in a single switch. You're saying you could do all this in one box?
That's right. Yes, we can do it all in a single pass, and we support 100 gig line rate at the same time.
So this gets down to the performance of the ASICs inside of the Mellanox switches is really low latency. And I think, if I remember rightly, now I've done some work on your switches at customer sites, is this goes back to that InfiniBand heritage that Mellanox has got. Your ASICs are actually incredibly low latency and just very fast.
The core competency of Mellanox is producing high-performance silicon. And we build our products around that core competency. So we build the switch silicon, we build platforms around that silicon, and we provide an open framework of software on top of those platforms. So customers who want to run web scale applications and want to build web scale networks, they have the option of choosing Cumulus Linux. We also have our own homegrown network operating system, which we call Mellanox Onyx. So that's another choice if people want to use classic CI. Like interface for the switches.
Now, one of the things I just wanted to point out here is that you're actually specializing in 100 gig switches, aren't you, too? You seem to have a lot of models. When I was checking up on the models that you're currently selling today, nearly all of them are 100 gig, and there's a really nice one, which is a 16-port 100 gig.
That's right, yeah. So we have SN2100, which is a 16-100 gig port switch. It's a half form factor. You can fit two of those switches in one RU form factor in a rack. Our storage customers really love it because it provides high performance, low latency, line rate, traffic switching. In addition to that, it provides this, one plus one redundancy, which is needed for storage traffic.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing is that you can take those 100 gig interfaces and break them out into 50s, 25s, and 10 gigs as well. It's not like you're stuck with 100 gig interfaces.
Absolutely, correct.
And also, Mellanox's open Ethernet strategy here means third-party optics?
Yes. So, in fact, that's an important point you raise. We differentiate based on our silicon performance, unlike other customers. As a result, we lead with open Ethernet. And with open Ethernet, we provide a choice of operating system, as I mentioned earlier. And in addition to that, we provide support for third-party optics as well. So NetNet, when you use open Ethernet, it provides transparent pricing and reduces the solution cost substantially.
So that means that Ethernet strategy means that I can use third-party optics if I want, but if I also wanted to have that end-to-end feeling, I could get Mellanox optics and Mellanox NICs, and then I'd have an end-to-end solution where everything works.
Correct, absolutely. So in fact, that is what we want to provide. We have high-performance building blocks, and we provide customers the choice to pick their choice of building components and then build their networks.
Now, you said something earlier about your EVPN. You talked about the scale. Now, one of the things that happens when you start doing L2 over L3 is you need a lot of tunnels. You need effectively a VXLAN tunnel for every single VLAN at least, but they get out of order pretty quickly. If you start extending the VLANs all over the place, you end up with, well, thousands pretty quickly. How does the Mellanox silicon scale there?
The pipeline inside our ASIC is very programmable, and it's very different compared to rest of the pipeline in the industry, be it from other vendors. Because of that, our overlay scale is almost equivalent to the scale we have for our underlay networks. As a result of that, we are able to support perhaps even more than 100K tunnels. 100K is a conservative number. We can support 100K VXLAN tunnels, and this, we believe, is especially useful in one of the contexts which you earlier mentioned, when the EVPN goes into the server, when you have virtual switches running in the server, participating in the EVPN, essentially you need the number of servers in the entire data center determines how many tunnels you need. With 100K tunnels, you can build a substantially big fabric, and that's a big advantage we have over other solutions.
I'm thinking of containers on top of VMs on top of, you know, and you're talking 200 containers per VM, you're talking 20 to 50 VMs per server. You need an awful lot of VXLAN, and each container might be in a different L2 VXLAN overlay, and you do need a lot of them as well.
Absolutely, yes.
So the second last feature I want to talk about today is NVMe fabrics. Now, in storage networking, this is really important because it has to be lossless and it has to be fast. So you've got some stuff going on there, David.
Yeah, NVMe is taking off. It's the new way of doing software-defined storage on the fastest type of storage. And it does require RDMA technology, which on Ethernet is called RoCE. And it is difficult to do RoCE and VXLAN at the same time. And a lot of people, they just can't do it. Or if they do, it's using those loopbacks. And our switches can do it in a single pass in the same pipeline and kind of protect the lossless nature of RoCE while doing VXLAN.
So you're saying you've actually got to unstrap the NVMe data from inside of the VXLAN overlay so that you can apply the Rocky signaling to it to make sure that it's lossless and it's end-to-end?
Precisely. It's got to protect the congestion notification and quality of service parameters, even though it's going through tunnels.
Right. And that's really important because mostly when it's on, once it's inside of VXLAN, most switches, most ASICs, most operating systems just don't see any of that data.
Right, and we think it's important that you don't have to choose between doing high-speed storage and virtualizing your data center. People want both.
Yeah, we actually do. And more importantly, I don't want to have a data center where some things are in the basic, in the underlay, and operating, you know, natively, and some things are in the overlay. You want it to be either all in or all out kind of thing. It simplifies the operational load. The final feature that we wanted to hit on today was QNVXLAN. I've never heard of this before, so maybe hit me up with a brief intro of what that means.
Yeah, so what that means is normally you would say without QNVXLAN, you would say every VLAN maps to a separate VNI. And then if I need 4,000 VLANs, I need 4,000 VNIs. But what if you said, no, actually, I have a kind of an outer VLAN for that customer, and I have one VNI for that customer, and I could have thousands of VLANs for that customer all mapping to the same VNI. It's a way of kind of scaling. It's also very useful for data center interconnect type applications, where you'd like to be able to say, I don't want to kind of have to know every single VLAN this customer has. What I want to be able to do is get their VLANs from point A to point B, either in the same data center or in another data center. And QNVXLAN or QNVNI, as some people call it, solves that problem.
I've just made a note to go and learn some more about that. Well, that's all the time we have for this Packet Pushers Coffee Talk, thanks to our sponsor, Mellanox. Now, if you want to know more about what's going on here, go to mellanox.com/packetpushers, and they'll have a bunch of white papers and stuff there that you can download. And if you do go and talk to somebody there, ask them for a POC in a box offering. That's literally a proof of concept in a box, where Mellanox provides you with a bunch of gear, some sample test plans, and Ansible scripts if you engage them directly, so that you can do a test of all of this on your premises. We've got a whole bunch of links in the show notes that go with this, so get on over to the Packet Pushers website and look for the show notes on this one so you can get more information. You can find this and many more fine free technical podcasts at packetpushers.net. And remember that too much networking would never be enough.